morning. This is the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin, and we're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, June the 5th, 2019. We begin with the feature story, We Don't Need No Education. At this school, students teach themselves, or just play Minecraft. Welcome to the wild world of self-directed learning. This used to be a jail. Can you go outside with me later? A small, unexpected voice asked when Hope Wilder opened a utility closet on Sunday morning in August. It was the first day of school, and Wilder, the founder and director of Pathfinder Community School, had spent the morning greeting arriving students and their families. Good morning. Welcome, Ben. Welcome, Scarlett, she sang out. Their first stop was the shoe cubby room. Wilder told the kids they could leave the shoes on, but most people prefer shoes off. This is usually her preference, but chatting like parents with parents necessitated acting like an adult, so her chunky brown Chaco sandals stayed on. By 10:30, all 14 children had arrived. Most had attended Pathfinder's pilot program that spring, so they were familiar with the space. They settled in. A group of girls strung beads into necklaces at the lunch table, debating a post-lunch foray to the creek. You know, this used to be a jail, one declared. She's not wrong. Around the corner from a Costco and a couple of strip malls downstairs from a family medical clinic and a Montessori school, Pathfinder occupies the basement level of a stately brick building on Durham's Broad Street that was once a penitentiary. Sunlight slants through the tops of windows laced with old-fashioned wrought iron bars. The school may be new, but the institutional tube lighting, linoleum floors, and dropped-down acoustical ceiling have a distinctly old-school feel. Two boys were sprawled on a rug in the common area, quietly playing a nature-themed board game. Another child was stalking the central hallway in search. So, when Wilder opened a dark closet and heard a voice emerge from within, she knew better than to ruin a game of hide-and-seek. Yes, we'll go outside later, she whispered, and gently shut the door. Wilder wouldn't think to interrupt play to summon kids to learn. Here, play is learning. Children explore, take risks, practice skills, and most important, figure out how to get along. Pathfinder, a nonprofit with students between the ages of 5 and 14 that is now finishing its first year, is at the vanguard of a resurgent self-directed learning movement, which does away with classes, textbooks, and even teachers. It's rooted in the notion that innate curiosity drives learning, and structured lessons get in the way. The concept isn't new, in a sense. It stretches back to the beginnings of our species, but for the past century, it's been a bit player among educational models. Perhaps the best-known flavor is the Montessori method, which loosens age segregation and allows students to work at their own pace. But with established curricula and teacher lessons, even that is more a compromise than true self-education. Modern free schools like Pathfinder can trace their pedigree to an offbeat British boarding school called Summerhill, founded by the Scottish educator A.S. Neil in 1921. Neil believed children thrive in settings of freedom and approval. His book, Summerhill, A Radical Approach to Child Rearing, came out in 1960, anticipating the countercultural zeitgeist. It sold 3 million copies. It also inspired the creation of the Sudbury School near Boston in 1968. In turn, over the last half century, the school has spawned scores of imitators throughout the U.S. It's hard to overstate how radical the Sudbury model is. Consider that every county in America has standing armies of professionals paid to teach children how to read. Then consider that Sudbury Valley has no reading instruction whatsoever, yet its graduates all leave campus perfectly literate. That, advocates say, should count as proof of the concept. So too should the fact that Sudbury persists in a region thick with universities and anxieties about college acceptance, whose failure would be quickly snuffed out. Research on free schooling is slim, but the few extant studies that do exist, most by a Boston College psychologist who's become a proselytizer, suggest that alumni go on to college and successful careers in the same rate as children from traditional schools. It's enough to make you question the whole educational edifice, which is built on a foundation of grade-level benchmarks that require massive investments in teaching, testing, grading, homework, and discipline. Waller wants to scrap it all. She promises Pathfinder parents that their children won't be just as be prepared for the future as their conventionally school peers. They'll be better prepared. The school system is antiquated, she says. It's based on a system that was developed over 100 years ago to prepare people to be Prussian soldiers. But today's workplaces require dynamic, flexible, creative problem-solving, not taking orders from on high and not just doing what you're told. Also, everybody has the internet in their pockets. You don't need to memorize all the facts. Kids who do self-directed education ending up being incredibly confident and comfortable. Being uncomfortable is the ambiguous situation where there's no right answer. Waller's point, paradoxical as it sounds, is that if the goal is to turn out self-motivated, socially skilled, adaptable adults, the path to success may come not from making children work, but from letting them play. The curriculum is community. Children at Pathfire play a lot. They spend a lot of time outside. They ride kick scooters in the parking lot. They climb trees. They make forts. They run on the grass. With adult supervision, they leave school property and ramble in a creek that runs through a small wooded area a few hundred feet away. They also read, have discussions, or simply relax. There are only two compulsory daily activities, an end-of-the-day cleanup that recalls temple scrubbing, Buddhist monks, albeit with less efficiency, and more silliness and excuses, and a half-hour morning meeting. Organized by the adult staff, four paid, one volunteer, not all of whom are there at the same time, these meetings sometimes resemble conventional instruction. There might be a guest speaker, or there might be an update on how things are going with students, offering suggestions and how they might go better. Like Sudbury Valley, Pathfinder is democratic as well as free. So children take an active part in school decisions, not just on trivial questions like whether to install a vending machine, more on that later, but on much of the discretionary budget. The goal is to teach them real-world decision-making in a way feckless student councils never could. Students must also occasionally report for jury duty. Democratic schools involve children in conflict resolutions rather than having them abide by adults' decisions. And when children play freely, there's plenty of conflict. Adults are on hand to help diffuse arguments. But when a dispute can't be quickly resolved, a child can bring a complaint to a jury for mediation. In Pathfinder's first year, Waller discovered that while she and the other staffers will sometimes lead attendance, optional workshops, or teaching sessions on different subjects, usually by request, they're mostly teaching kids how to grow into social beings. She insists on a code of mutual respect. We're proactively teaching conflict resolution skills, Wilder said. The curriculum is community. In school and at home, this kind of socialization is increasingly rare. Children no longer roam freely through their neighborhoods the way their parents did. Social interaction takes place through after-school programs, parent-arranged play dates, and on social media and smartphones, which some psychologists have linked to a troubling rise in rates of teenage anxiety and depression. Meanwhile, traditional schools are piling on homework and ratcheting up pressure to perform on standardized tests. That's left some parents to seek out alternatives. This search can sometimes lead to Waldorf or Montessori schools, which still have structure but emphasize creativity. But there are other parents, unschoolers, as youth educator Don Holt first described them in the 70s, who want a sharper break with mainstream education. These parents reject not just traditional schools, but the very idea of traditional schooling. Linda Stoya is one of them. Conventional education, Stoya believes, teaches children to be compliant and asks parents to reinforce the message. She has two children at Pathfinder, ages 9 and 11. Before moving to Durham, she and her husband, as an assistant music professor at Duke, tried various public and private schools around Boston. Stoya found that the more freedom her kids had, the happier they were. Even in the Montessori school, which has so much more choice than other types of schools, it's still only a choice of what order do you want to do things in, she said. There is a root of authoritarianism. It's hard to pin down precisely how many unschoolers are out there. More than 2 million American children are homeschooled, about 4% of the school-age population. But most of their parents don't want to upend pedagogy. They're homeschooling for religious or moral reasons, because they believe public schools are unsafe or unstimulating, or because their child has special needs. This according to a 2016 survey conducted by the National Center for Educational Statistics. In that survey, 6% of homeschooling parents cited a desire to provide a non-traditional approach as their most important reason for keeping their kids out of traditional schools. Free schoolers draw from this pool. Indeed, half of Pathfinder's inaugural class was previously homeschooled, Wilder said. Legally, they still are. Despite its name, Pathfinder isn't actually a school. It's not accredited and doesn't have a state license, which means it doesn't have to abide by state laws on mandatory attendance and testing. It doesn't award grades, nor will it give out diplomas should it take on high school-age students. It will help them create portfolios as part of their college application process. Instead, it's a homeschooling resource center, a place that offers homeschoolers opportunities to socialize and learn in a small-scale, customizable environment. Because free schools are not regulated, it's unclear how many exist. Wilder says there are about 80 Sudbury schools in the U.S. There's also a new tech-influenced free school model called Agile Learning Centers. Since 2013, it's grown from two schools in New York City and Charlotte, respectively, to the more than 50 across the country. A volunteer-run website called Alternatives to School offers a partial list of more than 100 democratic schools, learning co-ops, and homeschooling resource centers in the U.S. and Canada, including 6 in North Carolina. In 2017, Harvard's Ed Magazine profiled one of the list's two triangle entries, Durham's Dimensions Family School, which had opened the previous year. It has since closed. That's not uncommon, Wilder said. Sudbury schools have a high failure rate, So, too, did the previous generation of free schools that arose across the 60s and 70s, characterized by their brief lifespans and the often loosely defined nature of their educational practice. To avoid that fate, Pathfinder, the only free school within 200 miles, Wilder said, needs more students. Like private schools, it's funded by tuition, or in the school's parlance, membership fees. Unlike most private schools, membership fees are calculated on a sliding scale based on household income. In other words, wealthier parents pay more, sometimes a lot more, than lower-income families in an effort to make Pathfinder accessible to a broader mix of Durham residents. Pathfinder's website says it needs to average $9,000 a year per member to keep the lights on. Wilder says the school will be viable with 36 kids. Since August, its student body has grown from 14 to 21. I was going to be a rocket scientist. 1 month into the school year, Wilder is running barefoot in the play patch, throwing knotted-up socks at her students. A group game sometimes follows the daily morning meeting, and today it's Sock Wars, a mashup of dodgeball and Star Wars that Wilder found in a 1970s vintage book of summer gift camp games. Like most activities at Pathfinder, neither Wilder nor any other adult organized the game, aside from bringing knotted socks and a rope to spread across the field's midline. The kids choose teams spontaneously, foregoing a draft or any other kind of systematic mythology. As a result, while the sides were equal in number, one had more of the older children by more athletic talent, and all the boys, if this made the game less fun, that's today, can carry into tomorrow's game. The functioning principle of free play is that anyone can quit at any time. This makes all rules negotiable, and keeping things fun is in everybody's interest. Sensing the imbalance, Wilder dove on the underground side. She gleefully rolled in the grass and chucking socks and calling out the opponents she successfully targeted. This is a typical principal behavior, but Wilder isn't a typical principal. That's not even her title. She's the school's executive director, or less formally, core founder and vision keeper, as Pathfinder's website put it. To understand Wilder's unorthodox approach to education, you have to understand her unusual history with schooling. By conventional measures, she was a prodigy. She grew up in Columbia, South Carolina. At 14, she entered a gifted program at Mary Baldwin College in Virginia, in which high school-age students live in dorms and take courses for college. After earning a year's worth of credit, and with a dicey home situation that she's reluctant to talk about, she mentions a divorce and a latchkey existence. She skipped high school. She never earned a high school diploma, enrolling at the University of South Carolina at age 15. She was too young to live in the dorms, so she and a co-conspirator from Mary Baldwin rented an apartment near campus. It's totally not legal, says Wilder, now in her mid-30s, with short dark hair and a ready grin. It was like this con that everybody was running on everybody. She graduated in 2003 at 19 with a double degree in biology and German and minors in chemistry and Japanese. I think that has shaped a lot of how I think about this because, for one thing, I had this accelerated, intense experience of the education system, and I was so good at it, and it was such a waste of my time, and I am so angry about it, the things I could have been doing instead of studying organic history, which was never been useful to me, and was really hard, and made me feel inadequate, like I'm stupid because I don't understand this. After graduation, she again charted an unexpected course. Everybody thought I was going to be a rocket scientist or something, she said. There was a lot of pressure on me because I was smart, to excel, and I was not interested in getting on that train. But I also had no idea. She was accepted to the Peace Corps, but didn't go. Instead, she worked for a year on a wilderness trail crew in Colorado. She realized she liked being outdoors, a choice that defined her professional life for the next decade. She read a self-help book and determined that environmental education would bring together her major interests. The first job she found at Seeds in Durham, involving teaching children. She discovered that she really liked it. "I have a very strong inner child," she emphasizes. Waller's resume reads like a directory of Triangle Kid Nature Program after school program assistant at Seeds, lead teacher at Schoolhouse of Wonder, science teacher at River Rock School on the Haw, outdoor school teacher at Clapping Hands Farm, camp counselor at Piedmont Wildlife Center, lead teacher at Duke Gardens. Some of her sessions were free-form playtimes. Other were school programs designed to sync with the state-mandated curricula. She could capture kids' attention, but she noticed how children left to their own devices would engage and interact with the neutral, natural world and with each other. In February of 2016, she attended a teacher training at Duke Gardens in which she pretended to be a fifth-grade student in order to train new educators. It was only a simulation, but it made her realize that she hated being told what to look at and where to focus her attention. She also realized that what she was doing when she was teaching. Wilder considered a career change, but that same month she attended a workshop at Marvel's Kids Museum in which the keynote speaker, Boston College psychologist Peter Gray, spoke on the importance of play. She left with an epiphany. Gray is a dean of modern self-directed education movement. His 2013 book, Free to Learn, Why Unleashing the Instinct to Play Will Make Our Children Happier, More Self-Reliant, and Better Students for Life, is its Bible. In the late 70s, Gray had sent his troubled son to Sudbury Valley and witnessed a remarkable turnaround. After that, he and his co-author, a founding member of Sudbury, decided to poll 75 alumni. Three-quarters, they found, had pursued higher education at a time when only half of the nation's high school graduates did that. 80% said their time at Sudbury Valley benefited their careers. In 1986, they published their research in an American Journal of Education. It was roundly ignored. For the most part, it still is. Among education scholars, Gray said, no one either bothers to argue that the Sudbury method is bad. Rather, it's so far out of their mainstream that it's not debated as a viable option. The subtitle of a 2015 Schools, Studies in Education article written by a high school English teacher pleads for attention. Why the Sudbury model of education should be taken seriously. Academics might have been indifferent to free schools, but the idea captivated Wilder, and in a flash it came to her. She should start her own school. It didn't happen just like that, of course. It took 2 years to lay the groundwork for Pathfinder. Wilder advertised, planning sessions at the library, found like-minded supporters and collaborators in the unschooling community, toured free schools all over the Northeast, including Sudbury Valley, and interned for 3 months at Arts and Ideas Sudbury School in Baltimore. She also raised money from what she laughingly describes as friends, family, and fools. Most of those funds came from spousal support, she said. Her husband is a software developer, but they're not rich. They live in an East Durham house that they purchased in 2012 for $99,000. According to property records, it's worth a lot more now. In 2006, the couple didn't live in a house at all, but rather in a sort of covered wagon bolted to the top of a car-towed flatbed trailer, completely off the grid, composting toilet, rain cash shipment, bucket shower, etc. On the threat of hefty fines, the city forced them to move their eco-friendly urban car van out of Trinity Park. "All we have is our personal choice," Waller told the Indy then. "We can't change the law, but we can choose to live the way we want to, or as close to it as we can." Waller secured a location for her school in fall of 2017. The next spring, Pathfinder opened for a pilot program, 12 kids, 3 days a week, 4 hours a day, for 2 months, just to test the principles of program in a low-stakes way. In August, it opened for its first full-year term. "I was terrified," Waller said. "I was completely terrified that it would fail. I was terrified that it would work. In the first few days, I relaxed because I realized these are just kids, and I know kids. I know how to be with kids. All I have to do is show up, and it doesn't have to be perfect." He can't sit still. Informally, this is a lunch table, but there's no lunch period. The kids eat when they're hungry. There's a nearby mini-fridge that holds food they bring from home, and this table is the main area, is often repurposed. Today, in September, it's a setting for a game of school. The children seem fully aware of the irony. 6-year-old Jenna announces that she's the teacher. "First class of the day, spelling," she said. For several minutes, they debate how to spell apple. Meanwhile, the terms of the game constantly change. Is this a college class or preschool? What's a better grade, an A or an O for outstanding? Is Q a grade? Quite good. But nothing to bang a drum about, they decide. Should Darwin get in trouble for sketching? Does it matter if he intends to be an inventor? Instead of staying on task, it bears mention that the older children carry the day with the standard spelling of apple. They think creatively, weigh each other's contributions, and collaborate. Jenna announces math class, and some kids drift away. She prepares a worksheet. 9-year-old Lucy is the first recipient. She begins to fill in answers and stops. "This says 10 equals 10. She tells Jenna. "It should say 10 plus 10. The answer is 20. Meanwhile, in the empty foyer, 8-year-old Ben has spent most of the day, most of the year, sitting alone, headphones on, staring into an iPad. He's playing Minecraft. It's a game that all the kids know, and they'll often play it together on three donated PCs in the computer room. The PCs have a 20-minute time limit if another child is waiting. But if a parent lets a child bring a device from home, they're free to indulge. This morning's meeting had a featured conflict resolution theater, a play put on by the adults, Angie Danmiller, an intern studying early childhood education at Durham Tech, and Daisy Courtney, an all-purpose helper, enacted the kind of roughhousing restricted to the rumpus room. Danmiller launched a foam sword attack on Courtney's pillow fort, then started swinging the sword at Courtney until she invoked the stop rule, saying, "Those two words together tells a playmate they've crossed the line." Their use in the play led to a discussion about respecting boundaries. Ben has mostly frowned through the simulation, but when the children were asked for their input, he leaped up, pointed at Danmiller and shouted, "She's a criminal. Bad, bad, bad." As the discussion continued, he repeated this performance several times, bringing the meeting to a halt as the adults tried to calm his potential rage. When the meeting ended, he retreated to the lobby, put on his headphones, and played Minecraft the rest of the day. A few months before Pathfinder opened, Waller invited Peter Gray to give a public talk at Duke Gardens. On a hot summer evening, in a wood-accented indoor meeting hall, Gray delivered a polished hour on his core philosophy. Children come into the world burning to educate themselves. And then we shut all those things off, he said. We put them into a setting which curiosity doesn't count because it's not their questions that matter anymore, in which play is not learning. It's research, recess, a break from learning, in which sociability, talking to one's neighbor about how to solve a problem, is cheating. A Pathfinder parent asks a question on everyone's mind. What about video games? Gray's answer consumed 8 minutes. He attacked press reports on studies that have likened the addictiveness of computer games to heroin and talked about research that shows that games can bestow cognitive benefits. Then he floated a theory that kids often play computer games and spend time on socialist media more than they even want to. We don't allow them to just go out and connect physically with one another, he said. Kids, especially by the time they're teenagers, but even before they're teenagers, need to be able to communicate with their peers without the prying eyes and ears of adults. Gray is a persuasive evangelizer. His blue blog on the Psychology Today website, Freedom to Learn, makes a case for self-directed learning as a part of an overall philosophy of respecting children and giving them space to grow. He's also the founder and president of the Alliance for Self-Directed Education, which hopes to build a movement to make such learning available to all children everywhere. All kids should benefit from free schools, he argues, not just highly motivated children or the white middle-class students who go to Sudbury. Free schools are often criticized as enclaves of the rich and privileged, their success stories dismissed as a result of demographics. Take this 2015 essay from the website Ravishly, in which a parent described her experience with Sudbury School like this, quote, "Only one student at a school was not white. Almost all students were middle class or higher, and many came from exceedingly wealthy households. Only highly educated white people seem willing to consider the idea that their children might learn best without any instruction at all." At Pathfinder, Wyler has struggled to achieve a racial mix that looks like Durham. Right now, only a handful of kids come from non-white families. She says she's trying to recruit more African-American staffers in hopes they'll make some non-white families feel more welcome. "We've done our racial equity work," Waller says, "and we're working very hard at the issue. But I don't think there's a magic way to solve it." She's had more luck attracting families from across the income spectrum. Walder, like Gray, believes self-directed learning shouldn't be restricted to the rich, which led her to develop a sliding scale tuition system that eases the burden on working-class families. A family with a household income of $40,000 would pay $560 a month to send two kids to Pathfinder. If that same household earned $125,000 a year, their monthly fee would increase to $1,750. Unlike Gray, however, Wilder doesn't think all children will do better in free school. "It's not a question of background," she says, "but temperament. I think there are people, adults and children alike, who prefer a structure, who prefer to have classes laid out for them, who aren't comfortable making decisions on a moment-to-moment basis. But parents whose kids struggle in conventional environments say self-directed learning has been a godsend." Daisy Courtney, a North Carolina transplant from New York City, says she came to free schooling because her 11-year-old son, Nate, wasn't well-suited to traditional classrooms. "Every teacher we ever had, it didn't matter what school or what state we were in, said the same thing. He still can't sit still. He's got a lot of energy. He's a class clown, disruptive. I knew he was energetic. I knew he was active. I knew he was so inquisitive to the point of being disruptive." Courtney is raised by strict immigrant parents from Costa Rica and had raised her daughter from a very first marriage to the same way. But the poor relationship that resulted disquieted her, and she resolved to raise her two kids from her second marriage differently. Instead of forcing Nate to adjust to traditional schools, she looked for alternatives. She considered unschooling, but she also wanted him to experience a community. She and her husband were willing to relocate for the right situation. They looked into the Agile Learning Center in Charlotte and other schools with self-directed models, but none fit their budget. Then she found Pathfinder's website and plugged her family's numbers into its online tuition calculator. After one phone conversation with Wilder, the Courtneys moved to Durham. Courtney took a three-day-a-week job at Pathfinder, she since left, and Nate became a precocious, energetic member of the tribe. Candy Junkies. As the school year progressed, Pathfinder lost one enrollee. Uli was a 14-year-old budding computer expert who took upon himself to administer the school's Minecraft server. There were few children his age, and he wasn't getting the social or intellectual stimulation he needed. So, in a sort of ad hoc graduation, he left Pathfinder to intern at the web services company where Wilder's husband works. But other children came aboard. Austin, not his real name, is a neurotypical 14-year-old who they had to pull out of school, says Wilder. He's blossomed. He's everybody's big brother. He's also a really positive influence on the other teams and tweens because he's really gentle and compassionate. Juliet is a 10-year-old girl who was also taken out of the public school. At her Pathfinder interview, she didn't say a word, and her body language was completely shut down, Wilder said. She spent most of her first week in the library in nervous apprehension. The staff left her to adjust in her own time. One day, a girl came to the library and asked Juliet if she wanted to play. She went to play, and basically, she hasn't stopped, Wilder said. Now, she's the kid who will not shut up. Having whole days free to socialize radically speed up the process of finding one's place, Wilder said. Pathfinder is like a social boot camp because you can have hundreds of interactions in a day. This can be hard on introverts. Wilder made the library's solitary activities only space for kids who need quiet. But the socialization has a tangible advantage. Free school kids are much more mature than kids their same age who are at school, Wilder said. It's a thing. In Sudbury schools, people usually guess kids are 2 or 3 years older than they actually are because they're so well-spoken and articulate. They're also noticeably more confident when speaking to adults. Whether this is desirable may be a matter of taste. The seen and not heard adage comes to mind, but the ability to speak freely to authority figures may bode well for future job interviews. 6 months into the school year, 9-year-old Lucy became a candy tycoon. She was in the habit of bringing candy to share with her friends. She sensed an entrepreneurial opportunity and started charging them a nickel or a dime. This turned into a game called Candy Store, in which candy was exchanged for high fives. Eventually, she asked her mom if she could buy a candy machine, the kind that dispenses a small handful for a quarter. The other children gave her permission to install it, with the proviso that 13% of the revenue would be shared with the school. It's a democracy, after all. So far, it has generated $100 in profits, spurring her to invest in a second machine that sells M&Ms and Jawbreakers. Soon another child brought a gumball machine. She got at a yard sale and filled it with chocolate-filled pretzels and malted milk balls. This crude plastic contraption makes no distinction between coin denominations, so important lesson in economics and basic arithmetic. The jury's still out on the machine's benefits and drawbacks. Some children are clearly obsessed, candy junkies, Waller calls them, while those from families who discourage sugar consumption have petitioned for an M&M dispensing machine. As a morning meeting, when Waller asked each child what was most needed at Pathfinder, a 9-year-old boy from the latter camp said, "No more candy, period." "These are the hot-button items of the day," said Wilder. "These are things that there's a large spectrum of opinions in the world, and they're really juicy topics that the kids can sink their teeth into." Another juicy topic, profanity. After consulting with parents, Wilder began the year with top-drawer enforcement of a global PG rule because at a free school she visited, she was put off by the fact that the kids swear like sailors. That rule has since been reinterpreted and modified by the school's cultural committee, in which the children hash out the school's ground rules and judge violations. The committee decided that Wilder's ban on R-rated words went too far, and with the exception of some truly offensive identity-disparaging terms, they could be uttered in private as long as everybody present was okay with their use. The kids also decided that crap isn't a swear word. "We talked about profanity with the kids," Waller said. "We talked about internet content filtering. We talked about sugar. Rather than the adults deciding everything for them and pretending we have the answers, we're engaging them in dialogue." At a Monday meeting in late February, the hot-button issue is screen time. The children are deciding whether to continue a new screen break policy in which the computer room is closed to encourage kids to play with each other, though they can continue playing games on their own. All eyes turn to Ben. He's spent the morning running, laughing, and playing with friends. While he still likes to play Minecraft, he recognized the value of external nudge to turn it off. The screen break was his idea. "Are you guys okay that again today?" Waller asked. Jill Turvin says yes. The rest nod, and the resolution passes unanimously. Ben thrusts out his hands. Thumbs up. We turn now to the news section. The wheels on the bus are falling off. Go Raleigh drivers are mad as hell at a management company they say has stripped their benefits and retaliated against employees who spoke out. After 10 years behind the wheel, Terrence Dewberry is used to every squeak and metallic clank from the hulking carriage of the number 7 bus. On Friday morning, his bus pulls out of the downtown Go Raleigh station at 5:45 sharp, with just 3 passengers aboard. An hour later, it will return with more than 20 riders collected along the South Saunders Street route between South Raleigh and Garner on their way to work or school or home from an overnight shift. In his second route of the day, and he's been up since 2:30, looking at him, you wouldn't think he's tired. "Let me know if it gets too hot or cold back there," he says from the driver's side, his eyes fixed on the road. He is tired, though. At 56, Dewberry has grown accustomed to a consistent schedule, and he liked not working weekends, a benefit of his seniority. But now that's gone. He works weekends. His shifts start at different times. His sleep schedule's a mess. And he says this new inconsistency has made his job more dangerous. Knowing your route like the back of your hand and seeing the same faces every day offers an added layer of protection. He no longer has that. "We are creatures of habit," Dewberry said. "When you have schedules that are inconsistent, that exposes you and the public to more danger." In January, the city overhauled its bus routes, an effort to make Raleigh's fast-growing bus service more user-friendly. But the drivers' union said, "TransDev Services Incorporated, the company the city has employed to manage the bus system since 1998, implemented those changes and eliminated some assumed seniority benefits with no consideration for their quality of life, leaving them with inconsistent schedules and untested routes." Worse, the union said, When employees voiced their concerns, Transdev retaliated, even trying to fire one employee. So on Tuesday evening, after the Indy goes to press, Dudeberry, president of the local 1328, plans to be among those of 100 drivers and allies who march down Haggard Street to City Hall, where they'll demand that the city fire Transdev at a council meeting and a press conference. City officials paint a beautiful picture of the Raleigh Transit Authority, and they want the Raleigh Transit to be a model for the regional transit. But they're not telling the whole story of how the bus operators are unhappy and how they are being treated, says Dwight Spencer, a spokesman for the drivers. The bus operators have lost faith. They have lost confidence in the management team. They must be replaced, starting with Transdev General Manager Marie Parker. Parker, who has worked for Transdev for 2 decades but became general manager in 2016, says she's disappointed to hear that the drivers are calling for her job. She denies many of the union's claims, including the retaliation accusation, which she calls unsubstantiated. The city spent nearly $10 million expanding the Go Raleigh system with routes connecting to Southeast and West Raleigh, the largest expansion the city had seen in a decade, according to a May 24th memo. But that plan led to new schedules for all bus drivers, whereas previous expansions only affected new drivers and those with less seniority. For Dewberry and other longtime drivers, that meant they could no longer count on weekends off, a benefit that they'd taken for granted. Transdev denies that it eliminated benefits. The only seniority benefits in the contract the union signed in 2018, Parker said, are route selection. The most senior driver chooses his or her favorite route, then the second most senior drivers, and so on. And the order in which the drivers can choose their days off or pick up extra shifts. Guaranteed weekends off weren't part of the deal. No processes for selection of schedules have changed at any time, she said. Seniority might let you pick first, the drivers pointed out, but that doesn't matter if there are no good choices. The union says the drivers weren't told about the scheduling changes before they ratified the contract afterwards. Transdev declared the changes within the scope of the bargaining agreement, and they weren't given a chance to weigh in before they went into effect. Parker says it's simply not true. The drivers had plenty of opportunities to speak through 2018, she said, including at 6 safety meetings and the city's monthly Ask a Planner session, which started in October. Transdev managers learned of their concerns about the route revisions in December, shortly before they went into effect. Although the proposed routes were within the acceptable parameters per our collective bargaining agreement with the drivers, she said, the team decided to make schedule adjustments to address concerns. We were able to prepare and present revisions reflecting the driver preferences to the union as early as late February. Those tweaks weren't enough, the union said. After a mechanic complained to the Go Raleigh board earlier this year, Transdev fired him over a minor unrelated offense, Dewberry said. The union filed a grievance, and the mechanic was allowed to return to work, according to the union. But the message was clear, don't cross us. Parker said she can't comment on personnel matters, but she denies that any retaliation took place. The progressive disciplinary process for accidents and or other rule violations was followed properly in this case, she said, adding that disputes regarding discipline go through a grievance procedure, as happened here. Other employees have spoken at public meetings, and there has never been any issue. Beyond scheduling, Parker said, Transdev hasn't heard of other concerns from the union. The salary schedule negotiated in the contract, she said, is extremely competitive for this industry and region. Along with a pension match, on-site gym, and health and dental benefits, drivers earn between $15 and $23 an hour. The average salary for a full-time driver this past year was close to $50,000, she said, while the top 10% of drivers averaged about $75,000. The math suggests that drivers work a lot of overtime. And the public is happy with the expansion, Parker said. The positive feedback based on the new Sirius has been overwhelming, as the service has proven to be well-utilized and much needed by the citizens. But the drivers aren't happy. They're protesting Tuesday night, Dewberry said, because they have no other choice but to make their fight public. Transdev won't give its veteran drivers respect they've earned, he said. They don't see the point of view of the driver, Dewberry said. They didn't care for the people who went through hard times. They try to cater their schedule to the people coming in instead of the people who have been here, and that's just morally wrong. Nathan Spencer, a Raleigh Transit Authority board member, says there's plenty of blame to go around, including the authority itself. When the scheduling issue surfaced in December, Go Raleigh was stuck between a rock and a hard place, between the riders who needed better service and the drivers providing it. Go Raleigh management probably could have done better across the board with the rollout, he said. I mean, this was the first experience for us on all ends. When I say management did a bad job of rolling this out, I mean that management worked in the dark to put this together and handed the drivers the info, he said. Based on your contract, we have to hand this to you now. They weren't let in on the process. The public was. The other parts of the service city, the other agencies were. But we didn't include the drivers, and we should have. The next news article, resign to run. The Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina is making David Knight quit his job to run for city council, even though the law doesn't require it. The Oxford Road sidewalk was a turning point, David Knight said. 5 years ago, when he lived in Five Points, he ran along that road, and like many of his neighborhood, he thought that replacing the well-worn dip path next to it was a no-brainer. But in January, Raleigh City Council member Steph Mendel convinced her colleagues to kill the sidewalk project, though it was several years and $20,000 in the making, citing the complaints of a few residents. Mendel has since reversed course, and the sidewalk is back on track. But Knight's mind was made up. A vague feeling that he should do more for his community has turned into a very real desire to take Mendel's seat. But when he disclosed his plans to his boss at the Economic Development Partnership in North Carolina, a nonprofit business incubator under the North Carolina Department of Commerce, he was told he'd have to give up his job as director of the Outdoor Recreation Industry's office, which pays six figures, to run for city council, a part-time gig that pays about $17,000 a year. He plans to resign on Wednesday, Knight told the Indy last week. It's unfortunate, and I think I could have done both. I had to choose, and I've chosen to run. There's nothing in state law that requires such a choice. State employees can run for political office as long as they don't use their employer's time or public funds. This week, mayoral candidate Clarence Sullivan stepped down as executive director at the North Carolina Business Committee for Education, which operates out of the governor's office, though she remains a senior advisor. Patrick Bufkin, a candidate for the District A city council seat, is a staff attorney in North Carolina Utilities Commission. He says employers have accommodated his desire to seek public office. We've developed an arrangement that would put the appropriate safeguards in place to make sure I can get my work done and also get in touch with the folks in North Carolina, Raleigh, that I want to represent on the council, Bufkin said. Knight thinks that he could have made a similar deal with the EDP. After all, it's nothing new for state employees to seek local office, and it isn't surprising for a region that hosts the state government, several large public universities, and has part-time governing bodies. Longtime Carrboro Mayor Lydia Lavelle, for example, is a professor at North Carolina Central's Law School. Jerry Cohen, a former special counsel to the General Assembly, worked for the state when he was a Chapel Hill town council member in the late 70s. It wasn't a conflict, but it was a lot of work, Cohen said. There's no flat ban on state employees running for nonpartisan state office other than you can't campaign on state time, he said. It's unclear why the EDP forced Knight to step down to run. Christopher Chung, the partnership CEO, declined to comment for the story. Knight, 50, calls himself a business-minded environmentalist. He's the first person to head the EDP's Outdoor Recreation Industry Department, which aims to connect businesses to state resources. Outdoor recreation, he points out, a $28 billion industry. For a long time, I have believed that Raleigh was on the right track, Knight said. Now it seems we have lost that strong leadership, and the city's not moving forward. He argues that Mendel is part of a council clique that caters to a vocal minority. We're overlooking the bigger picture, and decisions like the Oxford Road sidewalk displays a tendency to disregard the opinions of the city staff. Downtown development, Knight says, should focus on multimodal connectivity that gives residents a variety of transportation options, with sidewalks being the most basic element. I'm very confident my constituents are happy with my representation and my outreach and engagement with them, Mendel told the Indy Monday. I knew not everyone is happy with every decision I've made and every vote I've taken, but the vast majority of people, the support is pretty overwhelming. And now a notice of a public hearing. The North Carolina Department of Transportation will hold a public meeting regarding the proposed project to widen Aviation Parkway from North Carolina 54, Chapel Hill Road, in Morrisville, to I-40 in Cary. The existing roadway will be widened to four-lane, medium-divided roadway with bicycle and pedestrian facilities. The purpose of this project is to address congested issues through 2040 and to improve safety along Aviation Parkway. The meeting will take place on Wednesday, June 12th, from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Morrisville Town Hall. Well, that's about it for another week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And a reminder, this program will be available as a podcast following its initial broadcast. So until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning.